introduce to you a good friend and colleague of mine, Dr. A.U. Dan Daniels. Let me tell you a little bit about Dan before he starts, and I won't take a long time because our time is shortened. Dan has a PhD from the University of Utah in metallurgy, and at the present time he's associate professor of surgery in the Division of Orthopedic Surgery. He's also research associate professor of engineering at the University of Utah. He's been involved for many years in the interdisciplinary confrontations that come between medical school, engineering school, and so has been very interested in the interrelationship of the science and the arts and philosophy and engineering and medicine and all of these things that kind of come together and cross through some of the things he's doing. Principally, however, through his work in surgery, through engineering and the physical sciences. He likes to teach. His wife describes him as an intellectual and a Renaissance man, and he's a great guy, and I think you'll enjoy very much his talk and paper is on Unsquare Dance, the New Literary Synthesis of Science, Religion, Philosophy, and Aesthetics. Professor Dan.
In response to the business about the Renaissance man, on my good days, I think I'm, that means when we get a grant, I think I'm the Renaissance man. On my bad days, I think I'm jack of all trades, master of none. And any of you who have dealt across disciplines, I think, have felt that. To set the tone for this talk, I'd like to take 2 minutes and play you an unsquare dance. And that's what all this business here is about. Notice anything strange about that? Count the time. Time signature. Anybody know? Yeah.
3:30.
Yes.
Not
7:08. Okay. I'm going to read this talk because this is these things we're going to talk about today are abstract, and I'm going to read my talk to you. If you want to interrupt me, feel free. Yes. That'll help you. Yes, I will. You've just heard Unsquare Dance, a 25-year-old musical experiment written by Dave Brubeck in 7/8 time, 7 beats to the measure. It gives one the feeling of always trying to catch up. and never quite succeeding. A feeling that seems particularly appropriate to the effort we must make today to stay abreast of knowledge in the face of an information explosion. Is that loud enough? Okay. Most of us try to survive the blast by specializing in narrow fields of information and realms of thought, both professionally and in our intellectual avocations if we have them. If we are the least bit curious, and I suppose all of us here are, or we wouldn't be attending this symposium, we suspect that although this tactic preserves our sanity, we are missing something juicy. We wonder whether some discovery or insight in another discipline or some literary invention might be just what we always wanted to hear. About the spotlights are what need to go off. For some 20 years, my wife Mona and I, assorted members of the Sunstone Executive Committee and Advisory Board, and their spouses and other old friends have met together monthly, confronting the explosion, leaning toward ground zero, snatching pieces of literary shrapnel out of the air as they ride on the shockwave, and then passing the hot fragments around. Each of us in book club, it's never had anything but a generic name, has had yearly chances to choose books that all must read and be prepared to discuss. Consequently, all of us have read things and made connections that we most likely would have missed. The book total is around 150, and it's an eclectic collection of literary classics, pop psychology, histories, biographies, modern fiction, and more unusual offerings, including some of the books I'll discuss today. As might be expected, the book club selections often have led many of us to seek out and read other books on our own. The four books that I have read recently and I'm going to speak about today are a good example. I think they represent a new genre. I have found these books full of important ideas, new insights, and fresh connections that make me stretch my mind and smile. My purpose today is to share a sampling of these ideas with you, hoping that you'll decide to take an invigorating plunge into this small, deep literary pond yourselves. I don't think the genre has a name. Some might call it pop science, but that's way short of the mark and sounds too much like the magazines in the barbershop under the stack of Playboys. I've tried and failed to think of a really good name. The best I can do for now is New Renaissance Literature. At least that's better than the general nonfiction category in which these books win prizes. I suspect that if someone can coin a catchy and appropriate name that attracts intellectual attention, the field will bloom with writers eager to be identified with it. The reason is that although modern scientific thought is full of amazing ideas about the universe and the place the human mind and soul have in it, the ideas have not come into general circulation and are still waiting to be discovered and discussed by most of us. It's not that the ideas are too hard to understand. Gary Zukav, the author of The Dancing Wuli Masters, said in the introduction to his book, and I quote, "I went to see what physicists were like. To my great surprise, I discovered that, one, I understood everything that they said, and two, their discussions sounded very much like theological discussions. I could scarcely believe what I had discovered. Physics was not the sterile, boring discipline I had assumed it to be. It was a rich, profound venture which was inseparable from philosophy," unquote. The trouble is, let's see. The trouble is that although modern scientists are certainly not illiterate, their writing styles are almost always unliterate and not connected with common experience. Therefore, their work, no matter how innovative and startling, never has a broad audience or broad. Since I'm a scientist, I feel free to make that self-judgment. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Men love to wonder, and that is the seed of science." These new writers, these men of the new Renaissance literature, have replanted the seed and grown flowers that we can all admire for their beauty and herbs that we can use to season our thinking. Let's take a walk in their garden. As we step in, however, it may be worth noting that just as there is often not much new under the sun, some of this garden is at least shaded by big old trees. As many of you probably know, Lewis Carroll, the author of Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, was also Charles Dodgson, a professor of mathematics. Much of the captivating absurdity in the Alice books results from his fascination with logic and paradox. Anyone who reads his books is instructed in these subjects without even feeling any pain, beyond a slight itching on the inside of the forehead. Also, in our era, it is safe to say that no one has done as much to make the ideas of science available, meaningful, and just plain interesting as Isaac Asimov, a former professor of biochemistry. If you haven't read anything of his, do so immediately, and pick something that sounds awful like, oh, the world of nitrogen. You will be intrigued and educated, I promise. I suppose I should also not neglect to mention astronomer Carl Sagan, who is great with titles, The Dragons of Eden, for instance. The new Renaissance writers tend to be different, though. They are either not scientists at all, or they are members of an exotic new breed called information scientists. As a result, they are equipped to make connections between science and religion and philosophy and fine arts that seem to escape even the most literate of physical and biological scientists. First, I would like to introduce you to Gary Zukav, whom I mentioned previously, and his book, The Dancing Wu Li Masters. Zukav is a freelance writer with a liberal arts education, and as the book cover indicates, it's about the startling concepts of physical reality given to us by modern physicists such as Planck, Einstein, Heisenberg, Feynman, and Bell. Let me tell you about the book's title. The words Wu Li are Chinese, and like most Chinese words, they have many meanings depending on the context and pronunciation. One meaning they have when used together is patterns of organic energy, which Zukav helps us understand is a pretty good description of physical reality according to the principles of modern physics. In turn, pun not intended, Dancing Wu Li Master is a good description of a modern physicist. And Zukav quotes Einstein to explain why the study of physics is a dance. Einstein said, and I quote, "Physical concepts are free creations of the human mind and are not, however it may seem, uniquely determined by the external world. In our endeavor to understand reality, we are somewhat like a man trying to understand the mechanism of a closed watch. He sees the face and the moving hands, even hears the ticking, but he has no way of opening the case. If he is ingenious, he may form some picture of a mechanism which could be responsible for all the things he observes. But he may never be quite sure his picture is the only one which could explain his observations. He will never be able to compare his picture with the real mechanism, and he cannot even imagine the possibility of the meaning of such a comparison." Unquote. As Zukav says, most people believe that physicists are explaining the world, but the Wu Li masters know that they are only dancing with it. Zukav also uses other definitions of Wu Li as section headings for the major topics of modern physics covered in the book. Let me tantalize you with just one of the more bizarre concepts of modern physics and its philosophical and religious implications that Zukav covers. The concept results through completely rigorous logic from something called Bell's theorem. In the simplest terms possible, certain unconnected, virtually simultaneous physical events apparently influence one another. If the result is thus here, it is most often thus over there. The only explanation seems to be what physicists call superluminal or faster than light communications, or what you and I would call telepathy. You would, of course, have expected physicists to be the last ones to consider that there might be a way for someone, God for instance, to communicate instantaneously throughout the universe. Guess again, and welcome to modern physics. The new golden questions are, what do you really know about modern physics? Would you like to know more? I hope that I have caused you to answer these questions with, not much for an educated person, and yes, so that you will go out and buy the book. One caution about this book and the others I'm going to discuss. Just because I say they're well written and that they aren't science textbooks, don't expect them to be as easy to read as Parade magazine that comes with the Sunday paper. This stuff can be exciting, but you're going to have to sweat a little to get it. There's no such thing as a free intellectual experience. Next, I would like to tell you a little about the book Grammatical Man. About the book Grammatical Man, written by Jeremy Campbell. It's about another profound discovery of modern science, information theory. Campbell does a thorough job of convincing the reader that nature must be interpreted as matter, energy, and information. To give you a meaningful example, let me ask you if you know what is the most significant discovery in the field of modern biology. Those of you with medical backgrounds and those others who do well in playing trivial pursuits will undoubtedly answer that it is the discovery of the spiral chain structure of a certain organic molecule, DNA, which is short for deoxyribonucleic acid. This is not because the structure contains any new chemistry or physics, but because it contains information. DNA is the chief material of chromosomes, and the exact proportion and order of four chemicals in each of several thousand different DNA chains in each of several chromosomes within a cell is a code containing all the information necessary to create a living organism and regulate the function of the cell. Information theory is contained in a set of equations developed in the 1940s by Claude Shannon, a scientist who, oddly enough, wasn't much interested in informing people. He didn't write many papers, and he hated to teach, and he hated to give lectures. His equations make it possible to define information quantitatively, and they explain how to figure out messages even when part of the information is missing. It is not necessary, thank goodness, to understand or even see the equations to appreciate the concepts. For example, look at the slide of the cover of one of the other books. Even though part of the word games is missing, it is easy to figure out the message based on the order in the part of the message that is not missing. It says philosophical fun and something of a very high order. I think any of us could infer that the missing part of the message is games, even though Judy Marsh's children scratched the cover of the book. So that's it. The thing that sets information apart from nonsense, chaos, or noise, as the engineers call it, is order. Information is contained in order, whether it is order in the structure of the DNA molecule, orderly transmission of radio messages, or the order of letters and words on the printed page. In fact, the order, or lack of it, is what makes written works such as James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake either intriguing and exciting, or frustrating and boring, depending on your attitude and mental state. Here's a Joycean sentence. The how say to, it is what's this, he must, who must, worden shall. How much information is there? Well, it depends on the context, and it depends on your attitude, and it depends on how much more of James Joyce you've read. The sentence walks a tightrope between nonsense because the order of letters and words is not predictable by the rules of conventional English. The importance of information theory was actually recognized in specialized form over 100 years ago when the laws of thermodynamics or heat energy were discovered or invented. Take your philosophical choice. It was found that orderly systems are high in usable energy, and disorderly ones are low in usable energy. A piece of coal surrounded by oxygen is an orderly system. All the carbon is here, and all the oxygen is there. If the coal is burned, that is, combined with the oxygen, the system gives up energy and becomes disordered. The carbon and oxygen form carbon dioxide gas, which is a collection of stable molecules moving randomly about. The thermodynamicists figured out that the whole universe was steadily losing its stored usable energy or becoming disordered. If they had asked, anybody who keeps house could have told them that. They called the change in order entropy. You should see the entropy in our bookcase at home. from a Greek word meaning change. The equation that they developed to calculate entropy has the same form as the one Shannon devised to measure the amount of information in a system. He had realized that the principle of entropy had much wider applications than thermodynamics. That's enough of grammatical man, I think, except for one thing. Since disorder is the most probable condition, it is one of the great riddles of science that so many of nature's products are so highly organized and therefore so highly improbable. Human beings, for instance. The scientific explanations often end up sounding quite theological. Read Campbell's book if you want to know more. The next book I'd like to discuss is perhaps the best known of the group since it won a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago. It is Douglas Hofstadter's Gödel, Escher, Bach, An Eternal Golden Braid. Hofstadter is an information scientist. You all know who Bach is, and I say is, not was, since this is a theological symposium. And many of you have seen and enjoyed the drawings of M.C. Escher, even if you don't always remember his name. Gödel was, or is, a mathematician, and you aren't supposed to know him unless you are one too. Gödel discovered, or again invented, your choice, a great mathematical principle and published it in 1931. It concerns something called number theory, or the description of the properties of whole numbers, which is pretty much the basis of all mathematical thinking. The principle is referred to as Gödel's incompleteness theorem. The theorem says that all consistent axiomatic formulations of number theory contain undecidable propositions and are therefore incomplete. Notice the all. It means there can't be a complete theory, no matter how smart you are or how hard you try. The theorem has left mathematicians depressed for years. All you need to do to get a feel for this is to see an example of an undecidable proposition. Here's one in plain English, although it should be in plain Greek since it was formulated by Epimenides, who was from the Isle of Crete. He said, "All Cretans are liars." I'm sure you see the problem. The statement contains a vicious circle, or what Hofstadter prefers to call a strange loop. Let's go around the loop a couple of times. If all Cretans are liars, then Epimenides must have been lying when he said all Cretans are liars, which means that not all Cretans are liars, so maybe the sentence is true, but of course if it's true, then all Cretans are liars, so the sentence must be a lie, and so on forever, or at least until you're sick of it. Another term for a strange loop, or something that is self-referential, is a recursion. What Hofstadter shows in his book is that mankind has shown an aesthetic fascination with recursions. For example, here is Escher's drawing hands. A simple and complete paradoxical recursion. And here's Escher's waterfall. Small portions of this drawing are completely correct and logical, but the overall perspective is subtly twisted so that the stream of water runs recursively and perpetually around, and of course, always downhill. Although other visual artists have explored recursion, none has scaled its heights or plumbed its depths like Escher. Some people find these images disturbing or depressing, and others find them almost euphoric. You've probably created your own living recursive image by looking in a mirror hung opposite a similar mirror on the wall behind you. As Hofstadter describes so elegantly, our fascination with recursion extends to music. And the master of recursive music was, or is, Johann Sebastian Bach. I doubt that anyone who has heard Bach's music questions his genius, even if, like some who view Escher's drawings, they find his artistry more disturbing than appealing. In his canons and fugues, musical themes are played against themselves, sometimes delayed in time, sometimes shifted in pitch, sometimes inverted in interval, and sometimes even played backward. Bach clearly knew and loved the secret power of recursion. The recursive whole is much, much greater than the sum of the simple parts from which it is made. Hofstadter's argument that the works of these three geniuses, Gödel, Escher, and Bach, have much in common is convincing. They do form an eternal golden braid. Some of the parts of the book that deal with Gödel's mathematics are pretty heavy going, but neither your mother nor I will make you read this whole book if you buy it, and you don't have to feel guilty and think of the starving children in China for not reading every word. Just buy it and browse in it. It contains a whole world of ideas. The last book I would like you to know about, if you don't already, is called The Mind's Eye, with a capital I, Fantasies and Reflections on Self and Soul. It is by Hofstadter again, in collaboration with a philosopher named Daniel Dennett. The Mind's Eye is an appropriate sequel to Gödel, Escher, Bach, because it is about the ultimate recursion, the study of the human mind and soul by the human mind and soul. Before I talk about the subject matter, I would like to mention that the book is also fascinating for the way in which it is written and organized. As you will notice on the cover page, the authors say that they composed and arranged the book. Rather than saying that they wrote and edited it. Most, but not all, of the 27 chapters are stories, essays, or excerpts written by other authors, and each is followed by a commentary written by Hofstadter or Dennett. It is an amazing collection. It is split into six sections, and I think that you will find the section titles alone quite intriguing. They are A Sense of Self, Soul Searching, From Hardware to Software, Mind as Program, Creative Selves and Free Will, and finally, The Inner Eye. And they are nothing compared to the titles of the short stories and essays. Here are some examples. On Having No Head, The Soul of Martha, a Beast, The Riddle of the Universe and Its Solution, What Is It Like to Be a Bat, and A Conversation with Einstein's Brain. I couldn't resist buying the book after reading the table of contents, and I hope you can't either. There are too many interesting themes, concepts, and messages in the book for me to cover here. Among those that I found most fascinating were the discussions of artificial or machine intelligence and the nature of the soul, including thoughts on how our soul and our genes may be related and whether souls are unique to mankind. I think, however, that the most important message in the book is contained in an essay by Harold J. Morowitz called Rediscovering the Mind. What he points out to us is how modern science has led us to the ultimate recursion of studying ourselves. Modern psychology is increasingly concerned with explaining the functions of the mind in terms of biologic processes. And modern biology is relentlessly pursuing the goal of explaining all life processes, including the workings of the human mind and brain, in terms of chemistry and physics. At the same time, modern atomic physicists have concluded that the observer, that is, the mind, is not a result of physical processes, but is an essential and basic element in any fundamental description of physical reality. In Morowitz's own words, quote, "We have thus, in separate steps, gone around an epistemological circle from mind back to mind. The result of this chain of reasoning will probably lend more aid and comfort to Eastern mystics than to neurophysiologists and molecular biologists. Nevertheless, the closed loop follows from a straightforward combination of the explanatory processes of recognized experts in the three separate sciences, psychology, biology, and physics. Since individuals seldom work with more than one of these paradigms, the general problem has received little attention, unquote. Here are two more drawings which complete this illustration of the recursive process of the mind studying the mind. Pretty soon the mind realizes that the thing that it's studying is composed of the thing that it's studying, until we wonder what it is that's studying what. My conclusion to this journey that began as a walk through a garden is a simple one. During the centuries since the first Renaissance, man has increased his knowledge immensely. But in the process, knowledge has become increasingly compartmentalized. The new Renaissance literature, which I have described today, suggests that if we are to progress further in our intellectual and spiritual understanding of ourselves and the world about us, it is time to combine rather than to continue to compartmentalize. The result will be new ideas and insights that will dwarf what has gone before. Thank you for listening. Now go out and buy some of the books. Somebody want to hit the lights back there?
Will they pay you a commission on
No, I only accept, I only will entertain answers, not questions. Does anybody have anything they'd like to say? How many of you have read any of these four books? Good. We've gotten a lot of intellectual entertainment and enjoyment from them.
Who is the author of the second book again?
Jeremy Campbell. It's called Grammatical Man. That's the one about information theory. Yeah. Yes. Well, I took the quote from The Mind's Eye, but it was taken from Psychology Today. It's an article. The Mind's Eye is really an edited book full of things by different people, and Morawitz's quote is in The Mind's Eye, but it's originally in Psychology Today, and I don't know the issue number.
How real?
Very interesting. There are other books in this genre. There's one called God and the New Physics that I haven't read and would like to. Yes?
I was expecting you to make a defense.
No, I'm serious. That's why I probably have ended up in an interdisciplinary profession. It's interesting to me it's an excuse for being a perpetual student, I suppose. Well, the pay could be higher at the university than it is, but
the university
doesn't even hire. I don't agree with you entirely. There are a lot of us at the university who work across disciplines, and I agree it's not possible to see it. Somebody said that Leibniz was the last real Renaissance man. That's about 1700. Who could pretty much have a grasp of all knowledge, and there's no way I can do that, or you, or anybody that we can imagine can do that. So I'm not suggesting that you can synthesize all knowledge. I'm suggesting that there's utility and things to be gained from some kinds of synthesis across some kinds of boundaries.